Hi, I'm Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large of The Bulwark and the host of this podcast. We know how hard it is to keep up, and here at The Bulwark, we've been doing our best to help with daily podcasts, with our newsletters, and with features, and I just wanted to mention them to you. We do this podcast every single day, or at least every weekday, which makes it unusual. What also makes it somewhat unusual is that everything we do is free. We do not have a paywall. In the podcast, we try to keep up with the news of the day, but we also, or at least I certainly try to have an interesting conversation with interesting people every single day, many of them across the political spectrum. And we really appreciate all of you who have listened and those of you who have subscribed. Also, we do something else that's a little bit unusual. We put out three different newsletters every single day, and they are also completely free. I write Morning Shots in the Morning. Jonathan Last comes out with Midday with his triad, and Jim Swift puts out his email later in the day. And all of them are a little bit different, but all of them are incredibly valuable. We try to push out new information. I write quick hits, cheap shots, deep thoughts. Jonathan will often put some of his most thoughtful analysis in his piece. And Jim Swift has a great collection of things that you really ought to read, that you ought to look for. And so we try to do this. And then on The Bulwark itself, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this today, we've been working overtime to keep up with everything that's been going on. I mean, obviously, we've been writing an awful lot about the Trump administration and the presidential campaign, and we're going to continue to do that. But I wanted to call your attention to some extraordinary things that we've also done to document the record, the historical record on the coronavirus, including some incredibly valuable timelines. In fact, we've put them all together in one place. And if you go to my email this morning, my newsletter this morning, you'll see that. And if you click on our COVID-19 coverage, we have the complete guide to how Trump lied, bungled, and screwed America into this crisis. And this includes the 10 weeks that lost the war by Tim Miller. Tim Miller also put together the history of Trump's press briefing lies, all of the warnings the Trump administration ignored, a timeline of all the times that Donald Trump downplayed the coronavirus. Jim Swift put together all of the ways, all of the times that Trump went out of his way to praise China, how Trump went from praising China to blaming China, from attacking China to appeasing China. It is all there, as well as videos, where are the tests, and the anatomy of a viral lie. We also have essential reading from Bill Kristol, from Philip Rotner, Kathy Young, again, Tim Miller, Desmond Lackman. And it just occurs to me that one of the roles that we can play at The Bulwark is to make sure that we preserve the public record before we go into this Orwellian rewriting of history, before we have the usual suspects try to memory hole all of this. So we have tried to make The Bulwark into an essential resource. Anytime that you want to go back and say, okay, what was Donald Trump saying and doing back in January and February? What is the revisionist history? What are they trying to revise? It's all there. And I hope that you can use it as a resource. I mean, I hope you read it. But if you're so inclined, you can also download it. You can print it out. You can post it on your Uncle Fred's Facebook page. Again, the 10 weeks that lost the war, the history of Trump's press briefing lies, all the warnings the Trump administration ignored, a timeline of all the times President Trump downplayed the coronavirus, his record on China. And I'd also strongly urge you to just check out the Bulwark. We have a very deeply reported story by A.B. Stoddard, how Trump's COVID-19 failure betrayed our military and veterans, which is a very, very important story. Also, Christian Schneider has a great piece about the attack on the governors and urging us to remember who the enemy is. The enemy is not your state's governor who is trying to protect the public health. The enemy is, in fact, the virus. And Linda Chavez weighing in on Trump's immigration ban and why that is a self-defeating distraction. So, again, We have these things. They're all free. And I would urge you, if you would think about it, to subscribe to this podcast, to subscribe to the newsletters, check them out if you haven't done it, and on a daily basis to check back what we are doing, because we understand how difficult it is to keep up. Okay, so enough of the commercial for the day. Joining us on today's podcast, James Wallner, a senior analyst at the R Street Institute and an expert on the Senate, if there is an expert on the Senate, given what's going on right now. So thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
We've identified you in the past because you identify yourself on Twitter as an all-around procedural badass. So let's talk about where we're at right now. So the Senate, once again, votes nearly unanimously to spend another $500 billion. It's sort of like, you know, it's Tuesday, trillion here, trillion there. It adds up. So let's just talk about where we are at right now. They passed this compromise bill, which was designed initially just to restock the funds in the small business bailout fund, which ran out of money. Democrats were able to succeed in tacking on more aid for hospitals and for testing, but they failed to get everything they want. So give me your sense of exactly where we're at right now.
Sure. Well, look, I think what we know is what we read in the newspaper, and I suspect that you and I could qualify as being members of Congress based on our knowledge of this bill, right? members of Congress don't even fully know what they're grappling with now and what they're doing. And I think that's extraordinary. I think that's extraordinary. And I think that your listeners really need to dwell on that for a minute, to think about the sheer size and complexity of the legislation that has been passed, not only yesterday, but in recent weeks, to combat this deadly pandemic. And it's being passed by members who are voting for it, in many cases by voice vote. They're not even there, and they don't even know what's in it. And I think that Wow. really does underscore a lot of the dysfunction in Congress today and why our politics is just so messed up.
This is a really interesting point. Right before we started the podcast, I said, hey, I really haven't been paying that much attention to the details of the legislation. I've been reading about some of the unintended consequences and the screwed up implementation of previous bills. And you basically said, well, you're then no different than a member of Congress who's voting on it, because these guys are not reading what's in the legislation. There's lots of moving parts. It is a tremendous amount of money. Some people argue it's not enough money. But it's, you know, so the mood basically seems to be, we just have to do something. We're going to throw the money up against the wall. And if we screws up, we'll come back and we'll fix it next time. Is that pretty much it? Or if it doesn't actually work, that's not really our problem. We're just going to, you know, vote yes on whatever piece of paper they're putting in front of us right now.
That seems to be it. And look, when we talk about the deficit, and the deficit this year is on track to be, I heard one report of almost $4 trillion. Now, I'm not suggesting that $4 trillion is too little or too much. The reason why I bring it up
I remember when people thought that was a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but I'm not making a policy argument right now. What I'm trying to encourage your listeners to do is to focus on that figure, to understand the sheer enormity of what is happening in Congress right now. And then to add to that, the fact that these bills that are spending trillions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, are passing with no debate. They're passing in many cases by voice vote, by members. They're being assented to by members who aren't even there. They're being written very hurriedly by leadership and committee staff without a full and robust process that goes into it. And when you have that kind of process, surprise, surprise, human beings being who human beings are, you get sloppy legislation. And you have a situation like we had yesterday in the Senate, where they had to come back and give even more money to a program that they did not fully expect to run out of money in the first place. These bills are poorly designed, they're poorly drafted, they're poorly written, and they're poorly thought out, it appears to me.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, one of the reasons they had to come back and put more money into this PPP plan is that it, speaking of unintended consequences, very large companies were able to come in, swoop up a lot of the money. It appears to have been very randomized. If you were a big company with a good relationship with your bank, you were probably first in line. People are looking around going, why did this company get the kind of money that the some of these large national chains getting huge amounts of money when the mom and pop small businesses aren't? There are other people who are writing op-ed pieces saying, you know, I actually am not hurting from this particular downturn yet, but I got the money anyway. And if I continue not to be hurt, they're going to forgive the loan, so I get to keep it. The potential for fraud is huge. So is there, you know, how do they balance out the anxiety that this thing could be, you know, scandal riven or that it could be wasted versus that the pressure to just do something right now? Or is that really not a balance in their minds?
I'm not sure that they are balancing that out. I think that members probably wrestle with this. They're probably concerned about it. But the way the legislative process works, when you have different members who believe different things and want to do different things, they get in a room and they debate and they argue. And the public can watch it. And they can hold their members accountable and they can ask them to do certain things and vote certain ways. And those members, if they want to get those people to vote for them in the future, will certainly heed their advice or try to at least persuade them that what they're doing is right. And out of that adversarial process, you get, I think, better designed, not always, but usually better designed bills. And a lot of that anxiety gets dealt with in the process. Well, right now, you don't have that kind of process playing out. So you're going to get fraud. You're going to get these types of things. And that may be okay. That may be the price we pay for the aid. But the simple fact is that that is a price that we are, in fact, paying. And I'm not even sure it's a price we need to pay. That's the other thing we haven't even talked about yet, which is, why are members of Congress not there? Why aren't they on the scene doing their job?
Well, I'm going to get to that in just a moment, because I want to sort of stop here, because it seems as if this new process has become almost normal, that you and I are talking about it, but it's just become accepted that we're almost living in a post-parliamentary world, a post-legislative world, where we are not seeing the process where committees used to meet and they used to discuss it and it would hear testimony and then would have a markup and then there would be debate back and forth and there would be experts who would look through it and then you would send it over to various analysts, whether it's the congressional research, you know, research folks, or whether it's you know, the budget folks who are going to, you know, vet the numbers. And then there would be a discussion. People on the outside would go through it. None of that exists anymore. And yet that's the way, when we talk about the American system of government, we just assume that that's the way congressional government works. That's the way we assume a constitutional democracy functions. And now there are basically a few people sitting in a room. They throw some stuff on paper. No one knows what it is. There's no transparency for the process. There's no debate. And yet it is rubber stamped and pretty much a shrug. And again, sort of stepping back on this, because I've been thinking a lot about, you know, democratic norms and democratic habits. And democratic habits can be changed after a while, that we get used to the idea of rule by executive fiat, or we get used to the assumption of parliamentary dysfunction and the irrelevance of debate or the irrelevance of a congressional procedure that we used to, you know, pat ourselves on the back of, you know, having that the Senate used to be the world's greatest deliberative body. That seems like a punchline now, or something that you would say ironically, given the process that you're describing right now.
Yeah, it seems like a really bad joke if you think about it. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. I like that, a post-parliamentary world. We've been in this world for a long time now. I remember back with the fiscal cliff, which basically refers to this situation where a lot of Bush-era tax cuts were expiring and the Congress was grappling with how to solve them. And they passed a bill on New Year's Eve, maybe it was slightly after New Year's Eve, slightly after midnight, without even having read it. They didn't even have copies of this bill. You had to go to a room and you had to look at the one copy they had they didn't even have it on like the computer somewhere, and people had like were writing things in pencil, and then members are just voting on it on the floor. And this is the way the legislative process works now. We have situations, cliffs that come up, we see them coming, the leadership and maybe people who want to pass certain legislation then present members with the fait accompli, and they say, take it or leave it. We'd love to let you offer an amendment. We'd love to let you debate this. We'd love to let you read it, but we don't have that luxury right now because time doesn't allow us to do it. And we have these big omnibus bills to avoid government shutdowns. We have things like the fiscal cliff bill to deal with the tax cuts. And now we have this coronavirus legislation. The only thing different about this is that at least when we first started passing coronavirus aid, we didn't see this pandemic coming. Now it's like we pass a bill and they're already talking about, you know, phase four, and Pelosi's saying we need $4 billion more to help states vote by mail. I mean, well, why aren't you putting that in the bills now? Why aren't we trying to have that debate now? It's like, well, we'll deal with that when we get to it, right? We can't debate this now, but we're going to debate it then. And by the way, you're not going to get an opportunity to offer amendments. You're not going to be able to sit in a room and actually argue about this. You're going to be forced to take it or leave it.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far afield, but I'm going to give you some sense of what I'm thinking as we're having this conversation. And people are going to think this is a wild digression here, but I may write actually something about this because I've been rereading this essay by Umberto Eco about fascism. And I'm not saying anybody's a fascist, okay? That is not my point. But he's talking about the mindset behind it, to understand it, the fact that fascism is not an ideology. It is not coherent. It is a beehive of contradictions. And he wrote this essay back in the 1990s. Actually, it was 1995, where, you know, he just talked about the attitudes. And one of the key attitudes behind the fascists, and obviously he had direct experience of what happened in Italy, was a style of populism that was in opposition to rotten parliamentary governments. You know, the contempt for parliaments, the contempt for this democratic process. And to the extent that the entire parliamentary process, the entire democratic process becomes discredited, it creates a vacuum in which people are more willing to look to the man on the white horse, the authoritarian who will say, you know, I will get things done. And again, this is what I'm seeing, is this creeping sense of that we don't have time to talk about it, think about it, or vote about it. We just simply must act. Well, that carries long-term implications if that becomes a political habit. So there's my little bit of a rant. Okay, so James, go ahead.
I think that's very wise. I think that's absolutely correct. And one of the things that I think creates the situation we have today is we look at Congress and we see a factory. We see a big factory, and we think that the members there they're assembling a product according to a blueprint that someone else designs elsewhere. And everything that matters is about the outcomes, the widgets. When in reality, Congress is a place where people go to participate in an activity on behalf of the people that vote for them, and incidentally, for the people that don't vote for them as well. And that activity, yes, it produces legislation, it's supposed to, but it also matters how that legislation is produced. And Congress is a place where you adjudicate competing claims and you legitimize outcomes in our system. You have to have that conflict. You have to have that disagreement. And when that's absolutely essential. And if you don't have it, what happens is that the system grows unresponsive to reform. It grows unresponsive to people saying, I think we should do X, Y, or Z. And it makes dramatic change more likely, which I think speaks to your point. And it inhibits this factory model. It actually, ironically, inhibits incremental change. And I think it leads to populist moments. And just think about the Roman Republic, for instance. Conservatives love to talk about the fall of Rome. Well, you know, I have a different take on it. I'm not sure it was this kind of loss of virtue. I think the Roman Republic was a pretty immoral place at the height of its power and strength. But if you think about it, just bear with me for a second, in 133 BC, you had this guy named Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus. I'm not very good of my Latin, may not be pronounced the correct way, but he's trying to implement modest kind of land reforms in order to reduce poverty and increase the number of soldiers in the army. right? He's opposed by the establishment.
Yeah, he was big big lefty.
Right. I mean, he may be what? Yeah, but he's opposed by the establishment, right? And basically, his supporters are slaughtered on the Capitoline Hill, which incidentally is the namesake of DC's Capitol Hill, but we'll just leave that there. And this starts and really inaugurates the beginning of the Roman Revolution, which eventually leads to the fall of the Republic and the rise of the Roman Empire. Now, fast forward to about 63 in the 60s BC, right? Almost 100 years later, you get Lucius Sergius Catilina, and he's this disgruntled, bankrupt aristocrat. And he's appealing to the urban poor with a populist message that's centered on debt relief, and is really channeling a lot of what Gracchus was trying to do way back when in a more legitimate way. And he's opposed by Cicero and the establishment, and his kind of ragtag army is eventually defeated outside of the city. And Cicero, the guy we all like and talk about all the time, he rounds up the co-conspirators inside the city. He has them executed without a trial. And that, guess what, leads to Cicero's expulsion from Rome and eventually leads to Caesar, eventually leads to the fall of the Republic. And it all comes down to the fact that the establishment begins to see this institutions in Roman politics is not a place where we adjudicate legitimate disagreements and fight about things, but is a factory that produces outcomes. And if people don't want to do what we want to do, then they can't participate in the process, and we try to push them out. Well, that leads exactly what you just said to more dramatic and far-reaching change and more populist-type moments. And that's not good for the system.
It's interesting, you know, as you describe this, this focus on the procedure and the constitutional niceties used to be central to conservative thought. It was, and there was the it's also central to an understanding of the rule of law, that it's not just about the outcome. It's also about the process, the procedure, the way that it actually functions and how fragile that can be. And at least, you know, we're having this discussion about how this legislation was passed, and it does remind me of many conversations that I used to have in the past when Democrats were ramming through Obamacare or ramming through this or legislation in the middle of the night. At least there was some criticism. Part of my pessimism at the moment is that what you and I are talking about, I just sense that there's not a lot of outrage about it. I'm trying to avoid saying no one gives a shit, but here's this moment that it seems like old and busted to say nobody gives a shit about the deficit, because we know that nobody gives a shit about the deficit. But now, in terms of the list of things that nobody gives a shit about, it is this decline of the parliamentary process. It is the complete eclipse of the congressional procedures here. And to the extent that Congress seems to be irrelevant, the strong executive will have more power. Okay,
yeah, so no, let's think of it, and think about it. It all goes back to the factory mindset. If you see yourself as building a table, right, or building a piece of legislation, then everything is a means to that end. And the rules are great so long as they help you achieve that end. And when they don't help you achieve that end, you criticize them. And I don't think it's hypocritical, incidentally. I think, you know, Republicans can criticize Democrats for Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and how it was passed, and then turn around and do the same thing. The reason why I don't think it's hypocritical is that Republicans think they have different ends than Democrats. And so therefore, they can break the rules. They can abuse the process when it helps them. But Democrats can't do that when it hurts them, and vice versa, for incidentally. And I think that both parties see Congress and see politics in the exact same way. And they think about it in terms of making things, building pieces of furniture. And that's not what our Constitution's all about. And that's not what our system of government's all about. Ironically, it's much more of a Marxist type view of politics. And I say ironically, because prior to this pandemic, you had Mitch McConnell, you had leading Republicans, their message was the Democrats are socialists. Well, when it comes to politics today, it strikes me that most Democrats and most Republicans in Washington, D.C., think about politics in a way that socialists would think about politics.
So let's talk a little bit about the strategy here. I read a tweet yesterday by a guy writes for Politico, Michael Grunwald, and he said, Democrats cave. Nothing for states or for cities, nothing for election protection or the post office, no oversight, no limits on fossil fuel bailouts, no food stamps. They got some testing, and somehow that's a GOP concession, but no contact tracing. So because I react in a knee-jerk way on Twitter, like because it's Twitter. I said, I'd really like to read an analysis of what the Democratic strategy here is. And Jay Caruso responded, and I think he's right here. He said, you know, this whole Democrats cave thing sounds a lot like the Tea Party GOP caved talk from back in 2011 and 2014. Democrats don't have a majority in the Senate. The original GOP bill only replenished the PPP funds. The Democrats did manage to get $75 billion for hospitals, $25 billion for testing, $60 billion in disaster funds. So this is one of those depends which way you look at it. I mean, you know, Grunewald's point is that, you know, why did you not use your leverage to get all this other stuff? And Caruso making the point, look, they actually did get some more stuff. So I mean, where's your sense in terms of like who caved, who's rolling who?
Well, this, I think, really underscores what we've just been talking about. And conservatives will find this very familiar, and liberals are now frustrated about the same thing. And it comes down to the fact, in my opinion, that when you write legislation behind closed doors, you don't adjudicate it and fight about it in the public. Right. That all of a sudden, the pivotal players in that process aren't very clear beyond the party leaders. You have no idea where the inflection points are in that process. You have no idea what happened behind closed doors. You have to take their word for it. And so right now, people can say, well, we got the best deal we could. And other people who are frustrated said, you could have gotten more. And no one is being confronted with the limits of their own reality. And so you get this kind of bizarre world where both sides are exactly correct. It just comes down to the faith you have and how hard the people on the inside are arguing. And no one knows unless you're in that room. That's no one knows. And so you can't hold them accountable, incidentally, which is great for members of Congress.
Well, speaking of being in the room, a lot of people aren't in the room. So we're now having this big debate about whether or not there should be virtual voting. And you earlier in the podcast, you said, well, why are they not there? Should they be there? Or in the age of social distancing, should we just change the way that Congress votes? And what implications does that have for the institution?
Well, I think the first thing is that we need to concede that there's no difficulty in getting to Congress. I think the point is what happens when they get there, and is that a safe thing for them to be there? And I think we need to approach it from that perspective. First of all, they shouldn't have left in the first place, potentially. And this is what Mike Lee, I think, made the point on the Senate floor yesterday, that if Congress needs to act, it needs to convene, or maybe it shouldn't have left town in the first place. The second thing is that if they're not in town, they have military transport jets. You can get in a car and drive across country if you need to. Like, people can get around now, and they can get around safely. So, but the problem is what happens when you get there in a large group of people? And I concede that's a problem, but you can come up with different protocols potentially. There's different ways of going about doing it. And I struggle with remote voting. I'm one of the few people who look at remote voting skeptically. I'm not sure it's constitutional. I think it certainly violates the spirit, if not the letter, of the Constitution. But the reason I struggle with it is that it looks at Congress like a factory. The idea that you have these factory workers and they can now do their job remotely. Well, what happens about the bargaining and the persuading and the negotiation and all this stuff that precedes the vote? That stuff really happens in person.
Well,
and I'm not sure you can carry it out if you're not there. I don't know how you do that.
Well, since it's not working now, and since we've been talking about this legislation being done behind closed doors, I have to admit, I have really mixed feelings about this, that to have congressmen who have to like be out in the real world and maybe communicating from outside the bubble of Congress is, yes, you do lose a lot. There's no question about it. But maybe it's not just a terrible thing, considering that being there and engaging in this sort of dysfunctional process doesn't seem to be the best possible solution. So why not have people elected from Wyoming stay in Wyoming? And since they've been elected, what is wrong with them voting from Wyoming where they're surrounded by actual voters, people who are impacted medically and economically by what they're doing?
No, I take your point very well, and I think it's a good one. And I wrestle with it as well. I don't think the way Congress is working even before the pandemic is good. I don't think that's a secret. But I'm not sure that voting remotely would reverse that. If anything, I think it amplifies it and exacerbates it. And right now, I think, you know, if you have members in Wyoming voting from Wyoming, they're going to continue to say that they're victims, that they have to look, this is the thing that I've been asked to vote on. I'm not sure, like, mechanically how it works. How do you decide who votes on what? How do you offer amendments? How do you overcome obstruction? You have to rewrite the entire rules. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 doesn't pass if that debate happens remotely, I don't believe. And
explain that to me, because I don't know the history there.
Because legislating is not a production process. Again, I keep coming back to this. It's an activity. It takes effort to prevail, and you fight about things. And then through that process, you reveal a greater understanding of the world. You and I argue about something. I see the world from a certain way. You see it from a certain way. When we come together and argue, we get a better understanding of reality in the round. We also get a better understanding of how strongly I feel and how strongly you feel, especially in the Senate, where maybe I can filibuster. And if you want to overcome, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm a small minority and I'm filibustering and I want to stop something, but ultimately I don't have enough support. Well, you can break my filibuster by forcing me to expend activity to do so. And even just think about the Constitution. They could have debated that via the mail in 1787. They wrote letters all the time, very detailed letters about their ideas and stuff. I do not believe we would have a constitution had they conducted their business via the mail instead of being locked in a room during the hot summer of 1787 in Philadelphia.
They also didn't have Zoom.
Right. But even via Zoom, I'm not sure
that FaceTime.
True, I concede that point, but I'm not sure it would have worked. Ted Kennedy wrote a book, and member memoirs are awful. They're generally not good books, but I read this one for some reason. I don't recall why. It's called True Compass. And in this book, Ted Kennedy has a fabulous quote that I think encapsulates and describes the Senate better than any other single kind of description that I've ever heard of. And he calls the Senate and refers to it as a chemical body. And he says that something happens when everyone is in a room and they realize they're not going home until they get something done. And I think that's true. I do. And I think that we get the amount of things that we can do as a nation will be reduced if our representatives are no longer getting together in a space and debating as equals about what they think we ought to do.
But you and I are having a debate right now. I'm sitting in Wisconsin. You're in D.C. I can express my opinion. I probably could make you, you know, understand how I'm feeling or how you're feeling about all of this. I mean, isn't this, you know, the reality is that it is millions of Americans right now are living their lives at a distance. Companies are working. The economy, to the extent that it still exists. And so why is it? I take your point about how, you know, human interaction is important. But it's not, it's important, but is it absolutely essential?
Yeah, so I think I take your point again, but it's the nature of the activity. Where businesses are making things. And so they can do that potentially, not always, but potentially remotely. You and I right now are making a podcast. We are producing a podcast. We're having a discussion. Yeah, we're arguing and debating, but we're still making something. We're not participating in an activity in which we're making collective decisions, some of which may be very, very controversial. If we were, I could just walk away, right? There's nothing that keeps us in the room. I mean, it's more akin to, you know, even like a physician. A physician can't do his or her job remotely. It's not exactly the same, because I do think being a representative, participating in self-government, it's an activity. It's a practice. It's something that you have to do. It's not like we're building things. And I think that practice informs our understanding and allows us to do bigger and greater things than what any one individual could do on his or her own self. And I think it's unfortunate, I think, especially for the people, because I want these people to be safe and healthy. I think maybe we can figure out ways to do it. But at the end of the day, the activity, in my opinion at least, requires them to participate in the give and take of politics. And that is something that I think you have to do in person. You can't have protest movements virtually. I don't think they're as effective. And it's for the same reason. This kind of fraternal spirit of camaraderie that fuels common action and helps you achieve a common cause doesn't really work if you're doing it via, you know, technology. I mean, it can help you facilitate that meeting, but that ultimately that action has to happen in some place, right? If the civil rights movement probably doesn't work if it doesn't, you know, if the Edmund Pettus Bridge and they're marching into Selma, but they're all really not marching. You just got one person marching and everybody's on Zoom watching them. It's not the same thing, right? I mean,
well,
you got to be present.
On the other hand, I certainly wish some of the open it up folks had come to a different conclusion, that they didn't actually need to show up at the Capitals, doing their gun cosplay and all of that stuff that they
no
they
could 100%.
But again, that's sort of not.
But 100%. But I guess my point is though that we're. The way in which we decide what government ought to do, the way in which we protect our freedom, the way in which we make collective decisions is by acting, right? John Adams says it's action, not rest, that constitutes our pleasure. Acting, and acting requires someone to be present. And you can, it doesn't mean you should always act. And I'm not necessarily sure I agree with the open it up movement right now. And I am very, my father-in-law is an oncologist who goes to work every day. I'm very concerned about this. My father was a physician. I take this virus and this pandemic very seriously, but I also wrestle with this need to act. And I think that ultimately people, the way in which we protect our liberties and our freedoms is by participating in politics. And I think that's what they were doing. And I think that that's something that we also have to acknowledge and wrestle with.
Yeah, I think we do. Okay, so what happens next? I'm looking at Politico right now. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is drawing a line. There will be no more attempts at long distance legislating on the coronavirus. So he's basically, signaling that he's kind of getting tired of this quickly shoveling billions of dollars out the door as the economy continues to crater. Therefore, there might not be a next step. What do you think? Because I think it's
interesting.
Based on everything we've been saying, the momentum seems to be that they have to keep doing what they're doing, because I mean they've now created their own treadmill.
Right. I think the first thing is that the nature of lawmaking, as you point out, I think so insightfully earlier in our conversation here, the nature of lawmaking, even when they all come back into Congress, is going to be the same as it is now. Right. They may be there and they may be actually casting roll call votes. But the way in which these bills are going to be put together is going to be the exact same. That's not changing. And that's not what McConnell's taking issue with. He may be reacting to it because there's greater and greater conservative unrest about maybe fiscal spending and other issues, deficit spending. But ultimately, right now, the president's calling for an infrastructure package. Richard Shelby is calling for an infrastructure package, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. You have, you have Democrats and Republicans working very closely saying we need more money. I mean, we're going to have more legislation with more money. That's going to happen. And it's going to be put together, I think, in a way that looks an awful lot like it is now and how these bills are put together. And so I'm wondering what McConnell is saying is going to be different, other than the fact that members are going to be physically present. And if that's the only thing that's different, then I agree with you. It's a waste of unnecessary threat to their health and safety. If they're just going to show up and sit there like bumps on a log, and rubber stamp whatever these leaders put together with the White House at the end of the day. That is an unnecessary threat, because that's not participating in politics. That's not doing the kinds of things that our system requires us to do to protect our liberties and be free. And they shouldn't show up if that's all they're going to do.
So how are you coping with the lockdown? Are you sheltering in place like others?
We are, but I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that I'm extraordinarily fortunate. And so we left Washington, D.C., my wife and my kids and my two golden retrievers, and we went to South Carolina. I'm in the mountains of South Carolina, sitting next to a crystal clear lake, Lake Kiawee. I mean, I go fly fishing for trout that are a lot smarter than me on a daily basis. I read the newspaper. I drink coffee. It's been a fabulous experience for me. And I say I'm reluctant to admit that, because there's so much pain and devastation that's happening around the world right now. And it's really remarkable to be in a place. And I'm so incredibly blessed and fortunate to be able to sit back and reflect on these things in a deeper way. And then a lot of people don't have that luxury.
It's funny, because my wife and I had this conversation, because we're sort of out here in the middle of nowhere as well. And so we're able to get out and, be in the trees and enjoy ourselves. And we have the luxury of being able to do our jobs remotely here. And of course we also have the dogs. But it also makes me reflect on what it must be like to people who are alone, who are living in small apartments, who don't have these resources, whose sources of income have been cut off. And I just, this is something I constantly keep reminding, that we don't really understand the full blast radius of all of this. But the most important question is, you have two golden retrievers. I'm looking at their picture because you're tweeting. You're like you know, we need to have dog tweets. So how old are those two guys?
So my oldest is 11. The youngest is 9. They're our first two children. The oldest, Buckley, is our firstborn son. He loves going on boat rides and getting into trouble, but they're everything. I mean, they really do. And I was listening to NPR this morning and there was a story and someone was talking about their cat that they had never had before. They didn't consider themselves a cat person, but they were holed up in their apartment and all of a sudden this cat appears out of nowhere and they're able to have a level of companionship that they didn't have before. And I don't know what I would do without my dogs. And I think that people like yourself and others really recognize the companionship that these guys provide for us, especially in times like this.
Oh, absolutely. And
my father-in-law he's an oncologist. He works and he goes to work every day and because cancer doesn't take a break during something like this. And talking about the hospital and talking about the patients and talking about the therapy dogs and how just happy they are, especially in a time when human contact has been reduced so drastically, it is remarkable. And I think it's important to remember how special these guys are.
You know, it is. And we've been really fortunate because right before everything shut down, we got a new puppy and who's about, I think, 5 weeks old. But he's growing like crazy. I mean, this guy, every time he's eating, he's making more dog. I think when we picked him up, he weighed 12 pounds and now he's 35 pounds. He's a German Shepherd and he's just a bundle of energy until he falls asleep. So he's playing with the other, with our other German Shepherd. We have a very elderly dog. Who's about 15 years old. I think they're terribly spoiled now because, of course, we're with them all the time as opposed to the way most dogs, you know, would go about their day, which is, you know, people leave for work and they're on their own.
Why are you still here? I need to sleep.
Well, see, so I have to work downstairs. I'm doing the podcast and everything, but my wife is upstairs with the dogs and she tweets out the dog pictures. So I know, listen to this, I know what's going on in my house, how the puppies are playing with one another by watching Twitter. I can see what's happening upstairs so that when I'm done with this, I'll go up and say, wow, it was a pretty active day. You know, is the puppy driving the older dog crazy and everything? So these are strange times that we are living in. And it's going to be interesting, the literature of this period, of all of the entire range and diversity of experiences from the absolutely horrible to the, this was kind of a break moment to the, I think I lost my mind. It's really, and they're all true. And none of them invalidate the other experience that people are going, I am experiencing massive anxiety. I can't sleep at night, over against the folks who are going, you know, this has been a interesting bonding experience with my family versus the people who say, I don't think I can stand my kids for another day. I mean, it's all, the entire world is out there.
I'm so glad you said that because we all experience the world in different ways. That's what makes us human. We're all different and we all see the world and have different experiences and all of those experiences are correct and accurate. And I think that one of the things that we need to keep in mind, this is an extraordinary moment in our lives. And I think it's going to shape our politics and our economy and the way we do things in this nation and around the world for years and years and decades to come. But I also think it's important to keep in mind that it's not necessarily new. And the reason I say that is that public health emergencies pose unique threats to participatory democracy because they make it harder for us to participate. But we've faced them in the past. And I think one of the dangers that we have today is that we think that, yes, this is an extraordinary thing, but it's not unique. And for instance, in 1793, there was a yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia. It was the capital at the time. Congress wasn't there. They had left in June, I think, of that year. They were slated to come back, according to the Constitution, in December of that year. And from August to November, there was a yellow fever outbreak in the city. Washington's there. Jefferson's there. Hamilton, he gets it. He's living there as the Secretary of the Treasury. During that epidemic, about 50 to 55,000 people live in Philadelphia, the capital. 20,000 of them, almost half, leave the city. 20,000. Of the people that are there, 5,000, almost 10% of the population, dies during this epidemic. This is a big deal. It is far-reaching. It impacts people's lives. Madison's wife, Dolly Madison, her first husband, dies during this epidemic. This we've experienced tragedy in the past. We've experienced really bad, awful things, and we've always come back as a people and a nation. And I think that it's important that we remember that, and we remember the sense of possibility that people like Dolly Madison and James Madison and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson had, the sense of possibility and the sense of faith in this country and the things that we can do, so long as we remember what makes us unique as Americans. And I think that is our system of government. It is the freedom and the liberty that we enjoy, and it's the ability to participate in politics as equal. And one of the things that I worry about is that when we have this factory model mindset of things, and this doesn't have anything to do with being a conservative or a progressive, when we see politics as about producing outcomes and widgets, we begin to cede our freedoms and our abilities to do things to achieve that end and to achieve that widget. And that is ultimately how you lose your freedom. And to go back to Italy, to go back to the article that you were referencing earlier, that's what happens. That's what happens in those places. And I think that in emergencies, we are especially prone to that. And the way in which I think we can guard against it is by remembering that this nation has faced terrible, awful things in the past. And we have always come through them. And we have come through them stronger and better. And I think that we can do the same here. But we have to remember what it is that makes us unique as Americans.
James, that was fantastic. And I did not think we were going to be able to end on such an uplifting note today, but I appreciate it and appreciate you coming back on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.